Blog Talk Radio.
Well, greetings, everyone. It is Sunday night, and that's the Mayor's Slap of the Bass. It is time for the weekend wrap, surveying the squared circle. I had a lot of action this weekend, as usual, provided by PBC, HBO, and our other boxing networks. Jabron, how are you doing this evening, my man?
I'm doing great, okay? I'm doing great.
Well, we're going to have to carry on tonight without Layman. Layman has some family business, take care of, being on the road and whatnot. I'm sure the wife keeps him, make sure that he performs the family and fatherly duties, and I'm sure you know about how that goes. We're also waiting for Scully. Scully's also taking the family down to the beach. So I get Jabron, what are we doing here, man? What's going on? are we the only ones missing out on the fun, or what? Or are we just that big a diehard fans?
Talking, I forgot I had my thing muted. I'm sorry. Me and the missus was gonna head down to Atlantic City tonight, but we holding off till tomorrow morning. So we'll get some festivities tomorrow. But even if I was down there, I was gonna get a call in.
Kind of makes me reminisce a little bit. I went to high school in Newark and spent some time down Asbury Park, Long Beach, and then I came back. I come back from the war. I did put in cable down there, and so Atlantic City, all along that Jersey Shore is kind of familiar territory.
Yeah, but. I didn't get to catch a lot of action. I did get to see the Heron fight. Right now, as we speak, I'm trying to get a little coverage on some of the fights from last night. I read some articles, some good articles, and seemed like it was some great action. I'm glad to hear that once again. Another weekend of successful boxing on free television.
Yeah, there were some good fights. There were some very competitive fights, and not to take away from any of them. It was great action for the casual fan. We didn't, of course, have any headliners. We did have some elimination bouts. We do have some good bouts coming up this weekend. But there's plenty for us to talk about before we talk about the fight. One of the things that I wanted to talk about, Deontay Wilder has signed up for beta testing, of course. Not only that, but for this fight, him and Areola are being tested for Vader. So, knowing that Al Heyman's fighters are on the right track about the Vader testing, and Chris Areola, usually the only thing that I know that he's been found positive of, unlike the is smoking a little weed. But I'd like to kind of get, your opinion on, first of all, how much more credibility does this give Wilder? And number two, are you buying what Povetkin is, more or less putting down about, they need to make the fight as quick as possible, and, he really didn't get caught with a positive drug test. It was, it was kind of like my man said before, it was in the food. I didn't know any better. Your thoughts on that whole kind of diatribe there?
Well, I just found it strange that he just turned around and was saying that he was going to, sue Dante Wilder, their camp and different things of that sort. I found that kind of strange because it's not like they're the one who did the test. Did you read any of those articles about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, like I said, the whole thing was strange. I mean, first of all, you have to give Deontay Wilder credit for agreeing to go to Russia and fight him in his backyard. Then after all of the BS, like you said, on their part, because at one time, Deontay was saying, hey, I'll fight him anyway, So, I mean, it was more or less his promoter that couldn't get his stuff together. Speaking of Povetkin's promoter, that couldn't get his stuff together in time. So, I mean, Deontay had to take something in order to not only to keep himself in shape, but to keep his name ringing because, let's face it, I mean, after Povetkin, he's actually taken a step down fighting Areola, but, hey, is he supposed to stay inactive while Povetkin gets his shit together? I don't think so.
No, and by him coming out doing this drug testing, I think it kind of takes away that negative feeling that a lot of the fans was having about him taking the Chris Areola fight. That's giving them the mindset that, hey, this guy is serious, about the sport, and he's serious about his craft, So I commend him on that, and I think it is a positive thing for him and his image.
Now, let's talk about the image. If you go on Facebook, and you've been there, you can see, in a lot of cases, we have a lot of venom on Facebook, a lot of us vent on Facebook. And I say us because I have certain subjects that I vent about. Boxing might not happen to be one of them, but I do. What do you think that even after all this time and the fact that this is our only true heavyweight champion, American heavyweight champion, especially, since Charles Martin is no longer a title holder. But what do you think about the venom that's kind of spewed at Deontay Wilder instead of embracing him as the American heavyweight champion, the only American heavyweight champion? Do you see that kind of a contradiction in terms, or do you see that as a sign of the times?
I think it's a sign of the times, but I think years to come with his career, if he stays on course and stays unbeaten, or even if he lost a close split decision to possibly Joshua and they did a rematch, ended up being a great trilogy or something like that. I feel like him gaining a little bit of, like, doubters or people that's really not on him right now will come around later. Because if you look at Floyd Mayweather, there's a lot of people that never really paid him any mind or gave him any credit, but then they started to hate him because of his personality. I don't think Dante Wilder's personality is a sense, like, profitable, in a sense. Like, America like drama. The times of this day, they like drama. If you're a good, clean-cut guy, it's like, you know, you'll have some fans, but when you're a drama type of character, you have your haters and then you have your fans. So it's like people see you to win and then they want to see you also to lose. So I think in the long run, Dante Wilder, he's going to be all right if he just stays on track and, you know, stay at his craft and be a great American heavyweight. Now, I think promoting going forward, he needs more exposure. You know, he need to get on some late night TV shows, daytime TV shows, need to get in commercials, different things of that sort. And far as Povetkin, he don't need to worry about him. He is other bigger fish to fry than him. You know, I feel like he's at the tail limit of his career also. Like, I'm not worried about that guy. Put it that way.
Well, the thing of it is that, you know, I mean, you know, if you want to unify the titles, Povetkin has one of those titles due to the fact of the way things played out with Klitschko. So, you know, so you have to include Povetkin in there because he has, I don't know, which maybe it's the IBF, I'm not sure which belt it is. But anyway, he has a belt. And I guess Tyson Fury and, you know, Tyson Fury has the other two or three or ten or however many it is. But, I mean, you know, see, you know, I mean, now, after, I want to say after Larry Holmes, but I think it happened before Larry Holmes. And I'm talking about the decline of the heavyweight division. And I'm not talking necessarily about talent, but I'm talking about with the reverence in which we held the heavyweight division and the heavyweight champion. When you were known as, you know, when you were the heavyweight champion, you were the, you know, excuse my French, you were supposedly the baddest motherfucker in the world. You know,
now,
you know, are you the baddest 10 heavyweight? Are you the baddest diamond heavyweight? Are you the baddest IBF heavyweight? Are you the baddest? Have we watered down the belts and the titles so much that people of your generation don't really give a damn anymore who the heavyweight champion is?
Yeah, I think so. Because at that time, it was like they wasn't just an athlete. It was like that they meant so much more to America. You know, like any social problems or issues, you know, you will have a heavyweight champion. They'll get their opinion or they'll speak or their support. You'll see, you know, George Foreman or Ali or different, you know, different heavyweights stepping up to the plate. And we just don't have that these days. And not only that, we're in the world of this politically correctness. So there's a lot of guys that just really don't want to stick put themselves out like that. You know, they want to say the right things and make the right people smile and, you know, kiss the right butt, because everything is a business.
Not, but you know, but even talking about business, and as you mentioned, you know, like you were talking about, you know, late night talk shows and, you know, daytime shows and commercials and all, you know, things of that nature. Well, you know, late night talk shows, I mean, back in my day, you know, they asked the champion to come on. It was so they could get publicity. You know, it was like, you know, hey, you know,
right.
You know, the heavyweight champion came on my show. Now, it's totally the other way around. You know, well, hey, the champ's going to be on Jimmy Fallon. Well, you know, it seems even in the business world, there are certain titles even now that seem to be, for instance, the welterweight title, or in any time Floyd Mayweather decides to fight, whatever weight it is, okay? Floyd doesn't go around talking to, you know, hey, man, can I come on your show? Can I come on your talk show? You know, do you have a couple minutes for me? You know, they go out and try to get Floyd. I mean, you know, and you can tell in the way that he is received, the way he is treated. You know, I mean, if you're in Las Vegas, you know, and you're waiting for Floyd and his entourage to come down, you know, at a press conference, it's all right for Floyd to be on Colored Folks Time, and you know what I'm saying.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
You know, but, you know, everyone else, you know, if you're sitting there waiting, you're getting kind of antsy, and, you know, like, who does he think he is? You know, it's like, you know, we're the press. This was reserved for people like Muhammad Ali, Kenny Norton when he beat Muhammad Ali, George Foreman, Mike Tyson, okay? You just don't see the respect. And, you know, I mean, we talk about respect in a whole lot of terms, you know, respect for education, respect for your teachers. But, you know, have we lost not only, you know, in our everyday lives, but especially in the world of sports, have we lost the term of respect when it comes to our athletes? Or have they been, you know, have the athletes committed so many atrocities that they no longer deserve that respect?
Well, that's a good one. That's a good one, JK. I mean, I feel like it's a little bit of both. Coming from both angles, like, for instance, it was a time when it was just a conversation. You'll be like, man, for $50 million, would you step in the ring with Mike Tyson? Man, no way, man. You know, it's like that. Fear, like you said, the baddest dude on the planet. And today, nobody fears anyone. So that level of respect, yeah, I really think that's gone. But also, like you said, you have to earn and gain respect also. And with a lot of athletes are not respecting the sport, you know, their craft. They're so caught up in the glitz and glamour instead of the fundamentals of the sport. And especially if you have a great athlete, they're just, you know, they're just getting there based off their athleticism and don't really have a lot of skill. That's why you have these guys that end up 10-15-0 and supposed to be the baddest thing on the planet and mess around and get stopped and get an upset like you did last night. And it'd be a wake-up call, like, hey, I got to really respect this game.
See, now, this is the only thing that I really hate about. Well, it's not that I hate it, but it's kind of, you know, kind of hard for me because I get so many segues into things that I really want to talk about. And especially by you being a young man, you know, and a couple a few generations removed. Let's be real here. A few generations removed, and it's you know, I'd like to get the outlook of your generation and exactly what's going on, because it not only does it reflect in the sports world, but it reflects in the world. So, kind of sticking with what you're saying, as far as athletes earning respect, you know, now a lot of, you know, there's, I think when you talk about Mike Tyson, when you talk about Floyd, you know, a lot of those, you know, were fighters that you love to hate, okay? Now, when we talk about the media, and us included, part-time anyway, okay? I look at the turning point for social media as Robin Givens and Mike Tyson. Because Mike Tyson's life was put on display. The only athlete whose life was put more on display to me more than Mike Tyson was O.J. Simpson. But that's, we'll talk about that a different day. So, do you think, I mean, even today, I mean, you know, when Mike Tyson walks into the room, you know, everybody knows who he is, and I'm not talking about Justin, you know, if he walks in the MGM Grand or, you know, I'm talking about if he would walk into your neighborhood bar, I'm sure there are three or four people that would recognize, if not more, would automatically recognize who Mike Tyson is. If I asked you who was the silver heavyweight champion of the Ukraine, you know, people would look at me like I'm silly. but that's not to say that he doesn't, that title doesn't exist or you know. So I guess what I'm going for is, you know, when there was only one title and one man, did that make it more polarizing? When, you know, now you have so much social media and so many other things that it would seem like, you know, you would get more publicity and more people would know you. Which, I mean, you know, where did we go wrong here?
Well, all right. Like you were stating about one belt or the man, where it's so saturated with so many different belts that it's like some of these fighters, they win like a NABO title or something, and they feel accomplished. You know, oh, I got a strap. You know, I was the Intercontinental Champion, you know. Like, I feel like when you have that ladder that you have to climb to get to the top, it's like that has you more focused, like, on a goal, the ultimate goal. it's like if you looked at basketball, it's some people that, oh, man, they would go crazy if their team made it to the playoffs. But it's some other teams that getting to the finals and losing is unacceptable. You get what I'm saying? So it's like they have all these belts and they get a little belt and it's like, hey, I made it. I'm the man. And they can go around and they can go around and be protected. They can be protected. You know, how they get these promoters to get them in there with these guys off the street and protect their record and pad up their victories, you know, like they was doing with Chavez Jr. at one time until he stepped into real competition, you know. So that's what tends to happen.
No.
JK? Oh, okay.
No, yeah, like I said, I mean, you know, there's so many things that perplex me here. Okay, now we kind of talked about it, and you know, well, let's talk a little bit about the Herring fight, because you did say that you did see that fight, right?
Yep.
Okay, now Herring. Once the TV was brought into view or was brought into play, and this was known as the main event, you look on every other boxing site, I believe. Now, I might be wrong, but if you look on the boxing site, if you look on, you know, if you look on the others, Eastside Boxing and whatnot. It was all the talk about Jamel Herring and, you know, the ex-Marine, Semper Fi. But if you look on ESPN, Herring was actually the B-side fighter. Now, what I'm asking you or the question that I'm leading up to is, okay, we all talk about TV rankings and whatnot, okay? So we know that, you know, Shumanov was Russian fighter, doesn't speak much English, wasn't well known over here. So the media kind of switched it up and made it, you know, Herring was the undefeated fighter, the ex-Marine, da-da-da-da-da. Mike Stafford in his corner, okay. But if you remember, you stood in a couple of shows with Abel Sanchez, and very, very quietly, Abel talked about his fighter, you know, told everyone how good he is in that little, you know, in that very quiet, calm voice. Never, you know, fall into the hype, Abel Sanchez. And both trainers, we'll say both trainers being equal, Abel Sanchez and Mike Stafford, okay? Jamal Herring coming in with all the hype, taller fighter, undefeated fighter. What do you think actually made the difference? I know we talk about heart, but, you know, after getting all the hype from the media and getting all the attention, what do you think actually made the difference, so much of a difference, that Herring corners throws in the towel? I mean, do you know how long has it been since you've seen a trainer get on the ring and throw the towel in? Do you know how much that has to sting? I mean, help me out here, you know, Javon. Tell me, you know, What's going on here?
That I was puzzled by that myself. I thought, first of all, you know, like you said, he's an ex, Marine or Army, and veteran and all of this sort. So I'm figuring, like, if he's going to go out, he's going out on his shield. You know, I know you want to protect the fighter, but at the time that they stopped it, when they stopped it, I could understand if he was getting pummeled with punches right then and there. But it was like they just casually walked along the side of the ring and just started waving the towel. And I was like, you know, it wasn't like urgent. Urgency. You get what I'm saying, JK? They didn't show like, hey, stop the fight. It was like all casual to me. That's just my perspective of how I watched it. It was just casual. I just found that to be strange.
Yeah, I know the safety of the fighter comes first, and I understand that. And you know, I mean, like I said, not to you know, take anything away from the fighter whatsoever. I'm gonna get Scully on here too. Scully said he's been sitting by the computer waiting, and I did miss him last week because I really want to kind of get the a professional point of view here and exactly what's going on that maybe we didn't quite understand, because I thought if he was going to go to the towel, then he should have thrown it in way before that.
Oh, yeah. Of course. At the time of the stoppage, he was kind of hurt. But I'm saying at the time that they threw it, like you said, I just thought the timing was just off.
Yeah, that the timing seemed way off, because I thought he was hurt a lot worse. I thought in the round and eighth round.
Right. That's why you just helped me explain what I was trying to say. That's what I'm saying. It was other times in the fight where I felt like, well, they could have threw the towel, but at the time when they threw it, it was just all casual. I just thought that timing was really, really off, and in the last round.
Yeah, as always, you know, we are graced to have the Iceman join us. Iceman, how you
yes,
doing?
Sir. Everything's good. Everything's really good. How you guys doing?
Oh, doing great, my man. You know, just talking a little bit about the fight last night and about the stoppage. And one thing that we couldn't understand, Scully, was number one, you know, why they seemed so casual about, you know, throwing in the towel. I mean, they, you know, it just seems like, as Jamal said, you know, he stood on the side waving the towel instead of, you know, actually throwing it in. And, you know, don't you think, I mean, I know you want to give your guy every chance, but, you know, don't you think it may have been a little bit more appropriate to have thrown the towel in the round before? Especially when Mike had said, you know, at the beginning of the round, you know, should we throw in the towel or I'm going to give you one more chance? I mean, you know, what was your thought on that whole scenario, Scully?
I mean, you know, it's I tell you, from personal personal experience. It's a really, really tough spot. Like it's easy, and I do it too, you know, to sit back and say, he should have done it. Obviously, he should have thrown it. But, I mean, you know, I've been in there, and there's a lot that comes into play. I'll give an example. I had a fighter, a good fighter. He was a top fighter. And we always talked about stopping fights. And I used to tell him, because I still had the mentality of, you don't stop my fight. You know, and when I was a fighter, I used to tell my trainer, before we used to walk out to the ring, I used to tell him, listen, don't stop this fight no matter what. I said, the referee's there. If he wants to do something, if the doctor wants to jump up, but don't you stop it. I'm telling you. And I would get, you know, I would get like really emotional, and he'd have to be like, okay, listen, calm down. I'm not going to stop the fight. And, you know, that's just how I was. And that's how this particular fighter was. As a professional trainer, I've only personally stopped two fights in my life. And his fight was one of them. We always talked about it, and as a fighter, I understood him, and I told him I would never stop a fight. But we got into a situation where I had to stop it. I saw it for what it was, and I stopped the title. Now, that was years ago. To this day, we've never been the same. He's never, you know, I can tell it eats at him, we're not nearly as close as we used to be. And it's just what we have to deal with. So my point is, you only get one chance. Once you throw it, you can't snatch it out of the air and bring it back. Once you throw that towel. And a lot of guys, you know, they want to believe that their fighter is going to make it through. He's going to pull through. He's going to pull a miracle. And, you know, and in cases like that, sometimes you think of Arturo Gatti, you know, out of just done for, and he comes out with a miracle left hook. You know, you see Holyfield. You see so many guys. Diego Corrales against Castillo. You would have bet your life he was gone. He was out of there. The fight was over. And he comes back and wins by knockout. So every trainer is kind of like, I believe they want to believe that chance is there. And it gets cloudy and it gets difficult. So I sympathize with trainers, because, like I say, once you pull the trigger, you can't pull the bullet back. And I think that's their big fear, is that they're going to – it doesn't – you know, sometimes it may look bad, but maybe in their eyes it doesn't look as bad. And they're afraid that when they stop it, somebody might be like, hey, you know, you should have let it go one more round. And so, you know, I don't really know what to say, to be honest with you. I I'm kind of torn on the subject just because of my history with it.
See, Scully, you bring up a very interesting point there once again, because if you notice, it was not Mike Stafford or any one of the trainers that actually was on the apron of the ring with the towel. I'm still not sure who that gentleman was, whether it was a promoter or who it was. Jamal, did you notice that it wasn't Mike Stafford or one of the trainers? It was a guy. It was actually a guy in a suit. So I didn't know whether it was his promoter or exactly who it was, and maybe that's the reason why the referee didn't seem to recognize, you know, the whole process until it was pointed out by an official or a judge over on the sideline. So, I mean, the whole situation seemed kind of strange, but John Scully, you brought up actually my next question. You know, how does that change the relationship between the fighter and the trainer? Like you said, you know, once that towel is thrown in, I mean, you know, is it a matter of confidence on both sides, or, you know, is a matter of the fighter just being able, you know, to look that trainer in the face once again? You know, and I mean, we talk about respect. Scully, is that what this is kind of all about?
You know, it's a really tough thing. And I tell you from my own personal experience, I tell you what happened. Muhammad Ali got stopped by Larry Holmes, 1980. I was 13 years old. And I remember reading the newspaper before going to school that day, and I just couldn't believe it. I just kept staring at the words, just was so, like, perplexed. I just could not fathom that Muhammad Ali got stopped. And I remember making up my mind, and that before I went to school that day, I said, I'm never going to be stopped. Like, there's no way. I said, I'm not getting stopped. Whatever I have to do, whatever pain I have to go through, blood, whatever the case may be, I have to not get stopped. So that's what led me to be where, you know, I had a fight when I was 15 years old and I was cut. And you know, I'm just a kid. I only had like two fights at the time. And the doctor came over and said he was going to stop the fight. And I like, lost it. I just went crazy. And I believe that's the only reason they let me go and finish the fight, because I made such a scene. So it's ingrained in me. So when I have certain fighters that are like that, it's almost like, you know, it's almost a negative. Like, it's almost like, you know, there's a whole bunch of Indians and there's no chief running things, you know. And I realized that there must be a chief. In the corner, the guy has to be the boss. But here I am, you know, and I'm telling the guy, yeah, we don't stop fighting, man. We go through whatever you got to go through. And the fighter's agreeing. He's loving it. He's like, yeah, whatever happens, man. If we get hurt, we get hurt. And I'm like, that's right. And then the moment came. In a very tough fight, and I knew it was over. And if I let it go, it was going to get ugly, and it was going to end anyway. It was going to end 10 seconds later anyway. I just saved them from getting, you know, bludgeoned. But to this day, you know, I don't think he's truly forgiven me. There's almost like a little, you know, like I kicked his dog one time, and every time he sees me, he's reminded of it. And you can feel it when we're around each other. And it's been years. It's been a long time. So you know that's the way boxing goes with a lot of people. You know, most people, I believe, in boxing, fighters are that deep about certain aspects of their game, and it can last forever.
Scully, you weren't here when we tried to scratch the surface here, but. You know, we're just kind of laymen, and you know, you, right now you're the professional at the table. And what I was talking about was when you talk about trainers. I mean, you know, you have Mike Stafford in one corner, you know, kind of a totally different mood from Abel Sanchez over in the other corner, who is, you know, kind of calm and, you know, always telling you, you know, like I believe the commentator was saying, you know, just calmly telling his man, you know, hey, you know, you worked the body the last two rounds. Now for the next three rounds, I want you to go to the head. You know, now I want you [S2] Wow. [S1] To do this. And very calmly. And Abel was the same way when he came on the show, you know, very calmly talking about this guy, you know, it's like, hey, you know, everybody's talking about hearing, but, you know, my man will do this, my man will do that, you know. And then you have hearing on the other side, who is also kind of a reflection of Mike Stafford. You know, now, both of these guys, as far as technique-wise, I think we could say that they bring, and the table is equal, the platform is equal. But it seems like one trainer is able to get a little bit more out of the gas tank of his fighter, while the other guy, his fighter is the favorite, not only in, you know, not only on the odds, but when you look at the technique and you look at the, you know, the strength of opposition and all this. Scully, how does one trainer pull that little extra out of what is an average to ordinary fighter to be an extraordinary fighter?
Right. Well, you know, a lot of things come into play, and I'll say this much from experience. Like, it's a lot easier and a lot more comfortable to work the corner of a guy who's winning as opposed to a guy who's unfamiliar with losing and is losing. You know, when you expect your guy to be swimming and you're sitting back watching him swim and then all of a sudden he starts drowning and you've never had to do CPR with him, all of a sudden you're not as calm as you were. Now you got to jump in, you got to grab him, you got to pull him to the side, you got to rush things. you know, I don't think they, you know, not that they overlooked the guy, but that I don't think they expected to be in that situation. And Abel's guy, you know, basically, for all intents and purposes, had nothing to lose. Like, it was a, you know, it was a situation where he had nothing to lose. He could just let it hang out and fight his fight. You know, like I say, it's a tough spot to be in when you're in unfamiliar territory. And even, you know, again, I have experience with it. Like when I had Dawson and we fought Hopkins, the game plan was so good, like against Hopkins, and it worked so good that even though it was a huge fight and we're fighting, you know, Bernard Hopkins, I mean, one of the greatest fighters of all time, I was so calm in the corner and so smooth. I felt so smooth just because everything was working, and I was like, I was so excited. I was like, wow, this is actually working. Like, the game plan is working. This is beautiful. Then when we fought Ward, and I knew all that we were up against, not just with Andre's, you know, overall being and his skills and everything, but also with the weight loss and, you know, there was tension with Chad and I and everything, and that corner wasn't so smooth. And our corner got out of control. I don't know if you remember the fight, but when we fought Hopkins, I was the only one talking in the corner. Everything was great. You know, it was all very smooth. When we fought Ward, we had literally three of us talking at the same time. These guys, at one point, a lot of people remember this, when I actually yelled, "Shut up! Are you people crazy? Shut up! Stop talking!" Because everybody was yelling, and it's because they didn't expect Chad to be losing like that, and they kind of lost it. So that's a mark of a good corner or a bad corner, and it's something you need when things don't go your way. Like, being a trainer of a guy who's winning is good, but you've got to be able to be a trainer of a guy who's losing also, and that's a tough spot to be in when you're not used to it.
Jamal, you got a few questions from Scully, or you know, some things that you might want to share with us?
Nah, I'm just soaking it all in right now.
Scully, you know, like you said, it's easy to be a winner, but you know, it's hard when you know, you see your fighter drowning. Considering, you know, all of the hype, because, you know, I mean, I can definitely relate to what you're saying, you know, from a military angle, you know, when you're in an elite squad and, you know, no man left behind and all of that, you know, but, you know, and, you know, make sure, you know, you can take the pain. But, you know, hey, when you get in a combat situation, some, you know, sometimes things change very drastically. You have to alter your game plan. You know, you have to keep your wits about you. You know, when all others lose theirs, you have to make sure, you know, somebody has to keep the ship afloat, so to speak. So, how is Mike and, you know, that staff going to be able to keep the ship afloat, meaning one Jamal Herring after, you know, a terrific beating, not just a loss. I mean, it would be different if it had been a loss, a close fight. But after a thunderous beating, John, how do you put it, you know, kind of like Humpty Dumpty, how do you put the pieces back together, man?
Well, this is where a trainer is really going to have to earn his money, because now, you know, people think training is just, you know, you hold the pads and you yell at the guy to work harder and you wrap his hands and you wipe his back with the towel and all these different things. But, you know, now you have to get your guy through the rebuilding process, and a lot of that is mental. A boxing coach, trainer really needs to be psychologically adept at working with the mind of a fighter. And you know, like I say, a lot of guys, they never, you know, Floyd Mayweather maybe, for example, other than the first Castillo fight, he's never really probably had to have Roger has probably never really had to work on Floyd's mind, because Floyd's never run into situations where his mind might have faltered. You know, he was flawless almost in his whole career. But now you have a guy like Jamal. Now he's going to have to be – he's going to have to find out who he really is, and his trainers are going to have to help him find that out, and they're going to have to test him. They're going to have to talk to him. They're going to have to work him through it. So, you know, behind the scenes is – you know, people could say, oh, so-and-so is the best trainer, and so-and-so is the best trainer, you know, but – you know, when you really find out who the best trainer is in situations that you'll never know about. You know, they've got to work on him behind the scenes, and that's what's going to tell how great of trainers they are. And not just trainers, but trainers for that particular guy. I don't know Jamal personally, so I don't know how he's going to pull through or what even is needed to pull him through. But they're going to certainly have to know.
John, you led me perfectly. You set the trap, and I'm going to fall right into it. Because when you speak of trainers, and you speak of fighters, and you speak of, you know, perfectly made, tailor-made situations, we hear that Ann Wolf reunited. I guess, you know, John, you know what that means. We're old enough, reunited, we, you know. Peter and Herb. yeah, so is it going to work? Is it going to work again?
I mean, who's she back with? James?
Yes, James Kirkland. They're back together.
Well, you know, it's like, here's the realistic thing. You know, I don't know Ann Wolf. I've heard she's a very good trainer. I've heard her. I know some people who are in the gym with her, and they say her workouts are like, you know, they're just not for everybody. Like, some people just literally can't handle what she dishes out. But unless she's a surgeon, you know, and she could fix psychological things and physiological things, you know, Kirkland is not the same guy he was a few years ago when he was coming back to her and she was able to connect with him, you know, mentally. It seemed to be they had a great mental connection that led to a great physical connection. But, you know, he's been knocked out. He's been hurt. You know, so he's a different human being now. And she's going to find it not so easy as it did last, that the success she had with him before. She's going to have to work a little bit harder now on his mind. Again, the mind is going to come into play here. Physically, who knows what he had, you know, what he's been through. Even away from the gym, who knows what he's been doing these years. You know, I don't get the impression that he's the cleanest living guy in the world. You know, he's out there and doing his thing. But, you know, I don't know. She's going to have her hands full because, like I said, this is not the same kid that she had the success with earlier. This is a guy who's been through some abuse, mental and physical. And that's a lot different to deal with than what she was dealing with before.
Yeah. Like you said, you know, I mean, it's well known. Ann's methods aren't, you know, for everybody. And, you know, but sticking with some of the guys that are making comebacks or want to come back, Antonio Margarito. He's going to have his second fight. It's going to be August 13th. What do you think about, I mean, even though he's going to be fighting Canelo's brother, Ramon Alvarez, I've seen him. I mean, you know, I don't think he's nothing flashier or, you know, I don't look at him as a second coming. Your thoughts on Antonio Margarito and the second fight of his?
I mean, my thing is this: anytime you have a situation like this, you know, when I was a kid, whenever anybody came back, I assumed like, oh man, they want to come back, they want to win the title. You know, they come back for the same reasons that they had when they were 20 years old. But this guy, you know, chances are high that he's in need of money. I would assume. I assume that's a big part of it. My thing is this: he's not going to be better than he was. You're not going to improve Antonio Margarito, and you're not going to be able to level him off. You're not going to be able to have him be as good as he was before. It's probably not physically or mentally possible, but he's certainly not going to be better. There's no doubt about that. And I don't think at the end that he was as good as he was. He had already dropped off. Now he's older, rustier, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure his defense isn't better. I'm sure his skin isn't better, his face. So, and at that weight with the guys, you know, you got some killers in there, in and around that weight. So I think it's literally like a classic case of a guy coming back, and he's going to get paid pretty well for some guy to, you know, torture him, you know, and just have that name on his record. I can't see him coming back and beating any of the elite guys. So, you know, I don't, if I was his brother or his mother or his father, I would certainly be trying to talk him out of this. So like mainly because of the defense thing, he never had a good defense. His offense and his strength was his good, you know, was his thing. That was what overpowered so many guys. But, you know, you don't take punches later on better than you did when you were younger. And towards the end, he started getting hurt. And now I think he's going to get hurt a lot more before he's done.
Speaking of getting hurt, John, you might have a different, you might see this a little bit different than I do, but promoter Eddie Hearn is pretty hopeful that he's going to get a fight between Triple G and Eubank Jr. John, you know, is this a case of a father seeking glory? You know, or does he just realize that, you know, maybe his son has a short career and he's trying to milk it for all it's worth?
Well, my gut feeling is that, you know, they want to get cash out, I guess they call it. You know, he wants to get the fight with Triple G before he takes a fight with someone else and gets beat, you know, and then ruins the fight with Triple G. You know, and it's, you know, people always talk about the old days, like, oh, the golden era of boxing, and back in the day they had to fight people. But I'm talking even relatively recent. I'll give an example. Marlon Starling, good friend of mine. He's in the gym with me every day. You know, he was a guy, if you look at his record, it's really remarkable. Like, before he fought for the title, he fought, I mean, Kevin Howard, Tommy Ayers. He fought Floyd Mayweather twice. He fought Donald Curry twice. Just Pedro Vieira fought twice. Just so many top guys. He fought so many 12-round fights. You know, back then, NBF title fights were 12 rounds. He was fighting 12-round fights, beating so many contenders before he ever even fought Breland for the title. You know, now a lot of these guys are getting, they certainly don't have to go that route. They don't have to fight the iron, and guys like Marlon didn't have that luck. So I would say that it's just a thing where they're going to just take the shot and hopefully get paid extremely well for it. I assume they know that they're more than likely going to lose and get stopped. And that's just how I see it. I mean, you know, because if it was just for the title, you know, they would try to go a lesser way, a supposed lesser guy, but they would make less money, I guess, than they would get for Triple G.
Yeah, well, most definitely. John, as always, well, man, hey, thanks so much for coming on, talking with us a little bit. Before you leave, I'm going to make you feel old, my man, because, you know, I know it certainly makes me feel old. Mike Tyson turns 50. So how long have we been watching Mike since he was, what, 15, John? I mean, you know. So,
you know what? I was there when he fought in the Golden Gloves. We fought in the same Golden Gloves tournament. It was held in Holyoke, Massachusetts back then. And actually, the first time I met Kevin Rooney was when Mike was there. Mike was 16 years old. They used to call him the Tank back then. And he knocked out a guy from Springfield, a grown man, by the name of Jimmy Johnson, in the first round. That was 1983. So we're going back a ways. And, when I read that, it really, really caught me off guard. 50, picturing him or anybody from my era at 50 just doesn't seem right.
Oh, man, I'm telling you, hey, but, you know, thanks for the memories, though, hey, John. Hey, let everybody know where they can find you on social media and anything you got going on, my man.
Iceman John Scully, all across the board, pretty much, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. And my big thing, you know, in a couple weeks, 3 weeks, I have my amateur boxing reunion, my fourth one that I've done. This one's going to be at the Mohegan Sun Casino in Connecticut. And I've got if everybody shows who says they're going to show, I'm going to have quite a crew there. Mickey Ward, Marlon Starling, Kevin Bryant, Dickie Eklund, just Jose Rivera. I mean, just tons of guys. Peter Manfredo. I'm hoping Mark Breland will be there. He's going to see how the fight with Deontay goes, and I'm assuming he'll be there. So that's my thing. So any amateur boxers, former amateurs that are listening, if you're in the area, Mohegan Sun Casino, July 23rd, we'll be there for an amateur boxer reunion.
All right, John. Well, hey, man, you know, hopefully maybe we'll get some of those guys on the show and, you know, you guys can reminisce with us. So thanks
a
lot,
man. That'd
be
great. All right, buddy. Good night, guys. All right.
All right, well, hey, Jabron, man, you know, I know you've been a little quiet over there the last few minutes, but, hey, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you on social media and anything else you might have going on.
Yeah, I was just soaking it up. He just threw it from a different angle about the trainer, about, you know, them bouncing back and you know, always winning, and then when you have to face adversity as in a loss. Like, where, you know, I just was soaking all that in, and, you know, that really makes you sit back and really think about, like, the real trainers or teachers.
Yeah. You know, that's why, you know, I talk when I get a chance to a lot of them. That's why I talk about, you know, the teaching part of it, because a lot of us don't get exposed to that.
Yeah, so you can find me, Jabron Clement, on Facebook, and always support boxing. Thanks for all the listeners, and JK, you can let them know where they can find you.
Yeah, I can be found at the Sports Crib. I can also be found West Coast Steelers fan, James E. King III. You can find me on Facebook. We do have a presence, the Pugilist Corner and the Weekend Wrap. You can catch archives of both on either of those websites. And Jabron, we just had one of our gentlemen in Las Vegas cover a knockout fight at the D, and you also, I've seen, put post articles on the page. So hey, we thank you for your contributions, and we also thank you for being on the show, and look forward to seeing you Tuesday, my man. You have a great night.
You too, JK.
Well, everyone, thank you so much for listening for another episode of the Weekend Wrap, Surveying the Squared Circle. Mr. Layman Brewster will be back with us again next week, and we thank Mr. John Scully for joining us tonight. So, hey, thank you, everyone, for your patience and being a great audience. Look forward to having you listening to us Tuesday on the Pugilist Corner. So have a great night, everyone, and look forward to seeing you Tuesday.